Connecting through storytelling. Well, there's a lot of directions you could go with this, right? So maybe I should start by introducing myself. And they said they couldn't introduce me because they didn't know who I was either. My name is Daryl Derstein. I'm from Holmes County, Ohio. I grew up in eastern North Carolina with the big black bears all around where they'd raid your trash cans and come up on your deck at night. And then I moved to Holmes County, Ohio in about 3.5 years ago so I could work for Christian Aid Ministries, which I moved up there to about 25 minutes west of where the headquarters is so I can drive in every day. And I have a wife of 15 years, Jessica. I had 7 children. We had 3 girls, and then we had 3 boys. And then we had another one. We knew that was going to be the tiebreaker. It turned out to be a girl. So now we have an even number, counting me. And now let's get into storytelling. I'm not an ordained minister, pastor, elder, so this is mostly going to be a storytelling session, and I hope you're okay with that. So what do we hope to communicate through storytelling? Traditionally, values have been passed down through stable societies through storytelling. So let's just start with a story. Let me tell you a story about my childhood. When I was fairly young, we didn't have a lot of money. And that's a good thing, because children probably shouldn't be raised with a lot of money anyway. And I didn't have a lot of the amazing toys that some of children grow up with today. And that's fine, because I had an imagination. If you have an imagination, you don't have a lot of toys. You can walk all around the yard and see all the things that aren't there. And it's wonderful. But one day, something happened that would change my life, at least in a small way. And that was a local Kmart went out of business. Now, what does this have to do with my life? Well, they ran a sale when they were going out of business. And if you're Anabaptist heritage, German, you know, back multiple generations, you know that if there's a sale, you have to go. You have to. It's the rule. And, I mean, you see it in Holmes County. There's these people that have been Anabaptists for generations and generations. They have yard sailing nailed down to a science. They have the areas divided up. This area is having their yard sale this Saturday, and this area is having their yard sale that Saturday. Maybe they do it the same way here. Well, we were way out in the sticks, so we didn't have other Anabaptists around. But still, if there's a sale, you have to go. So we went. And we went to this Kmart, and they had these huge signs in the window. A sale, going out of business, 25% off, 50% off, 75% off. Oh, we got in there. We got multiple shopping carts. We went through the store. We bought all the things you wouldn't buy otherwise because it was on sale. And I went back to the toy section because that's the most important part of the store, right? When you're a child. I went back to the toy section. And I was walking along looking at all the things I wasn't going to buy. That was normal. And I saw something that made me stop. It was beautiful. Hanging up there with all the other cheap junk was a cap gun. I mean, this isn't your normal cheap plastic cap gun that breaks after you pull the trigger 3 times. This is a wooden stock. It had a metal barrel. It had a hammer you could pull back and click and a little pan. Oh, it was beautiful. And I wanted it. So I went and got my mom. And I, you know how you do this? You get your mom. Hey, something I got to show you. And I know, just come on with me. And you take her back to the back. And she looks at it. And even 25, whatever it was, percent off, it was still too expensive, right? So I wasn't willing to give up easily. This was the most impressive toy I'd ever seen in my life. So I went and I got my dad by his thick finger and I took him back here. Dad, this is on sale. I'm just telling you, here it is. And, I'm just, hey, I wanted you to look at it for me. And I don't know what was going on that night. They was in a buying mood. Stuff was on sale. So they bought it for me. And we brought this cap gun home. And it was amazing. They even brought me a whole roll of caps. Now, these weren't the caps that you buy today that are all strung together in a circle. There were a long tape, red tape. Some of you who are old enough can actually remember these. It was a long tape you could lay out, and each, every about half an inch, there was a little raised black dot. There's some heads nodding back there. Yeah, I'm showing my age. And you could tear off each one. You could tear the tape off with a little black raised dot on it. And you could put it on the pan of the gun, and you could hold the, you could cock the hammer back. And if everything was just right and you didn't breathe on the piece of paper and blow it off, you could pull the trigger and the hammer would fall down, pap, and it would, little pop and a little puff of smoke. Oh, it was wonderful. The caps didn't actually last very long. And the reason they didn't last very long is because I thought I shot them all up. But later I was telling this story at a family reunion, and my mom came up to me afterwards. She said, you know what actually happened to your caps? Like, no, she's, well, your sisters. Stories, the sentences that start with your sisters usually don't end well, right? And she said they laid him out on the sidewalk, and they took a hammer and they went pap, 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 pap down the line and just blew him up all at once. And so when I'm telling this story to children, I warn little boys that if you get in a situation where you have something like caps that are important in your life, you need to hide them in your sock drawer, because they'll probably be safe there. Your sisters will probably just bring your socks up and pile them on your bed anyway. So they'll be safe there. But at any rate, my caps got all gone, and that was okay, because you could still pull the trigger and it would still snap down. And I had this wonderful single-shot muzzle-loading Davy Crockett cap gun. And I hunted all over the yard with it. It was wonderful. You could hunt across the front yard, and there is a zebra. You never know when you'll run into a zebra in the front yard in eastern North Carolina. And you certainly wouldn't want to miss the opportunity. So you would line your little cap gun up and pop! And he would fall over and one leg would kick. And that's, you always know you got him when one leg is kicking like that. And hunt down the side yard, and there's a Cape buffalo looking at you, like Robert Ruark said, like, you owe him money. And you would shoot him too. And he would fall over, and it was wonderful. It was the most wonderful toy I had in my childhood. And it only came to me by a fluke. So I was never going to get another one. But I didn't need another one. I had the one I needed. And one day I was hunting across the backyard. And I look up in the tree. And sure enough, just like so many times before, there's a big black panther sitting on a branch looking at me. And his tail is flicking, just flick, flick. And his muscles are rippling under his black skin, right? And he's sheathing and unsheathing his claws. And he's looking at me with his little slitty cat eyes. I knew what to do. I had a cap gun. So I threw it up and pop. And of course, I just winged him. He came falling down out of the tree, all claws and attitude, landed on the ground. Well, you've got a single shot cap gun. You can't shoot him again. That's not how you play the game. So I ran over to him and I switched the gun around in my hands. So the barrel and stock was in my hand, the barrel on the forend, and the stock was over my head. And I ran over and I went whack, whack, whack to finish him off, because it's the ethical thing to do. And in about the third whack, I broke that gun right in half. Right through the action area. The grain, through the pistol grip area, the grain kind of ran straight across. And it just broke right through there. You couldn't even play with it anymore, because not only was the stock gone, but the action was falling out of it. And all of a sudden, I wasn't the big hero anymore. I was just about a 7-year-old little boy standing in the backyard of his parents' home with the one toy that he was, the one wonderful toy that was better than all the others. And it was broke beyond repair. You know, when you're about 7, you're too old to actually cry. We all know this, having been 7. But you can, like, rub your fists in your eyes until you see those rings of fire in the air and that sort of thing. That's okay. And finally, I took it in the house and showed it to my mom. What was there to be done with it? It was actually pretty terrible. Well, my mom had a dad. And he was still around, still is around. He's 91 now. And she didn't know what to do either. But what you'll figure out, and some of you may be old enough to know this now, over here on this side, and you'll probably figure it out at some point, but that you think when you're a little girl, you can take your problems to your daddy and he'll fix them for you. What you may not know now, or maybe are just starting to figure out, is that's true even if you're 40 and your dad is 65. Your dad will still fix your problems for you. And so she took this gun to my grandpa without me knowing about it. My grandpa was a woodworker when he wasn't working at the Federal Wildlife Refuge. Now, he worked at the Federal Wildlife Refuge during a day job, and he was never able to advance because up so far up the ladder, even though he was very competent, probably the best worker they had on the whole unit. And that was because he wouldn't go through the whole law enforcement section you needed to go through in order to advance. But he was probably the person that everybody turned to when they had mechanical problems and something actually needed to get done. He was very faithful. You could about set your watch by him. He had this wonderful old truck he had put together. It was like a 67, 68, because the frame and engine was a 67, and he put a 68 body on. It's wonderful, curvy. You know how the old vehicles, they just kind of flowed. They weren't angular like some of the ones are now. And all these round headlights with chrome around them. And you would see him going by on the way to the Federal Wildlife Refuge every morning at the same time, every night at the same time, coming home. And then he would go to do what he really loved to do, which is mess around in his woodworking shop. Very faithful man. And my mom took this gun to him, and she gave it to him, and she said, "Can you do anything with it?" And he looked at it, and it was pretty far gone. He was like, "Well, let me see what I can do." I didn't know anything about this. Well, time went on, and one day that old 67, 68 pulled in the lane, and he got out of the truck, and he had my gun in his hand. It wasn't fixed. It was remanufactured. It was better than factory. Because the factory one broke. It was white pine stock and it had been stained dark. But my grandpa had fixed it and cut the stock out and inletted everything out of a solid plank of white oak. It was the same size and shape as the original, pretty much. But you weren't going to break it. You need to fit your tools to your users. And when you have a little boy who needs to smash panthers to death with the butt end of a scope gun, you need to be prepared for that. And he was. He had it so that you could do that in the future. And he got out of it, and he had this in his hand, and he walked up to me, and I came running out of the house. And my mom came out of the house. I think she was kind of proud of him. I assume she was. And she came out of the house, and he gave it to me. And my mom says, "You need to tell him thank you." Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. She said, "No." She said, "You need to give him a hug and a kiss." Ooh. See, when you're 7, you're practically old enough to have your driver's license. And you're definitely too old to be kissing people. Just say it. And, but you know what? He had fixed my gun. And so, you know what? You just, some things in life, you just have to do what you have to do. So I like to remember it like this, getting up on the big chrome front bumper, putting my arms around his big soft shoulders, giving him a kiss on that old whiskery cheek. And you know, when we die, we're lying on our deathbed, I think we're going to look back over our lives, and it's going to look a lot different than it often does in the middle of our life. And we're going to think, oh, that extra farm that I thought was so important to acquire that was next to mine, and having the best equipment and being the business that everybody turns to, I wonder really if that's going to mean much to you when you get down to it. But the love and the relationships that we build and the moments of love we share among ourselves will still matter when we're on our deathbed. And so there's a lot of things I won't have that other people may have and a lot of successes they may experience that I may not. But I did kiss my grandpa that day. And I'll always, always have that. Stories communicate values. Stable societies have historically passed down their values through story. There's a variety of reasons for that. Well, let's just think for a minute about this story. Why was this gun important to my mom? Why was it important to my grandpa? I mean, honestly, is a gun the single best choice for a wild-eyed little Mennonite boy? I mean, it's questionable in my mind. Storytelling is about connection and it's about relationship. And that's what this story brings out. We tell stories because they communicate that connection and relationship, and they create connection and relationship among listeners to the storyteller. And there's another reason we tell stories. It's because they work. It's a very pragmatic argument. Stories work when many, many other things fail. Now, stories do that for a variety of reasons. One of the reasons is we remember stories long after they're told. We can remember stories our uncle told us at a fireside 20 years after they happened. Like, how do you do that? And there's a beautiful, special point in storytelling. Because they are remembered long after they're told, you can tell them to a child, and the child will remember the story. The story can have an embedded lesson in it that the child is too young to understand. But it's there. And 20 years after the fact, maybe the child can be a grown up and in the middle of a situation that they don't know what to do with, and all of a sudden they can remember that story and they say, oh, that's what that was all about. Stories can do that. Now, there's a problem with stories, if you want to call it a problem, and that's that they're terribly inefficient. It's much faster for me to just tell you, this is what I want you to know. And then you say, oh, okay, that's what you want me to know. I'm the authority. You're the one listening. I'm telling you what to do. You just do it. But humans aren't really wired to operate so well that way. We want a relationship. And stories create that. Stories create that connection between the reader. And so they're terribly inefficient in terms of time. It takes so long to tell a story to make one point. But they're terribly effective. And when you're dealing, as Stephen Covey said so many years ago, when you're dealing with people, you have to let go of efficiency. Efficiency does not work with people. It works with machines and all sorts of other things. It doesn't work with people. It works with anything non-human, maybe. But when you're dealing with humans, you have to be effective. It's the only thing you can be. Stories also create synchronization. Synchronization is what happens in a room when you put up a good storyteller. And I've had the privilege of sitting at the feet of one of the best in the country at different times when he's telling stories, Donald Davis. He's a nationally known storyteller. And when you're in a room full of people listening to a good storyteller like Donald Davis, what happens scientifically is a room synchronizes emotionally, hormonally, intellectually. The room synchronizes and they go the same peaks and the same troughs and the same peaks and the same troughs. And when they're done, they're synchronized. And when you want to communicate truth, a value to people, and you do it through story, you create synchronization. If you're trying to convey a difficult truth to somebody, do you want to be in a synchronized state or an unsynchronized state? It's a pretty obvious question. Stories also create something similar to empathy. And empathy is wonderful. I remember one time Uncle Mark empathized with me. He was a big man with a beard, and he drove this old kind of beat up S10 with junk thrown in the back of it. And he would drive me home from work and he would tell me stories. And one day, this wasn't a story that he was telling me. It was just how he empathized with me. But here was somebody who had built a relationship with me by telling stories. And we're riding home from work, and I'm maybe 13, and I said to him, Mark, do you ever want to just be bad? Just be bad. And you know, there's a certain element within some of our cultures that just kind of tightens up when somebody says something like that. It was, oh, no, you don't want to be bad. That's a terrible idea. I always remember what he did. We're driving along with the windows down. He would drive slow, and that truck made so little noise. And you could hear the birds singing in the trees. He's driving along with his hand on the wheel, and after a while, he says, you know what, Daryl? Yeah, I do. Sometimes I just want to be bad. But he said, that's a bad idea, because when you do things, they have consequences. And when you do something bad, it has bad consequences. So you don't want to actually be bad, even if you want to. He said, the real problem is you're bored. Go do something zany and off the wall, but don't do something bad, because that brings consequences. And he empathized with me, and stories can create a similar empathy. You say, oh, this person is crazy just like I am, and you connect with them. Now, I want to just talk just a little bit about storytelling. Let's say you need to tell a story, because we all do. And because you're a human being, you're hardwired to listen to stories, and you're hardwired to tell stories. It's part of who you are as an individual. People say, oh, I'm not a storyteller. Yeah, you're a storyteller. It's like saying, I'm not an eater, or I'm not a breather. I don't do that. Yeah, you do that. You're human. And you also tell stories. When you see some tragedy on the way home from work, you're going to rush in and you're going to say, oh, this is what happened. You're telling a story, so you might as well learn to be as good at it as possible. And yet there are times in life you say, oh, how do I do this? Because storytelling can be hard. And you often just draw blank. You reach in there and your fingers close on almost nothing. Oh, how am I going to do this? Your child is, and some of you will run into this later in life, your child will say, tell me a story. And how many stories to tell? Well, tell them a story about your childhood, for one thing. It's really impressive. They did a study on a bunch of public school children, and they found that the children that had the highest levels of emotional health also were the children that knew the most about their mom and their dad and their grandparents and their grandparents and mom and dad's stories. That's probably not coincidental. The highest levels of emotional health. So let's just talk just a couple minutes about story. When you want to create a story, maybe to convey a point, and there's a very powerful case of this in the Bible where a prophet by the name of Nathan had to go to a powerful king by the name of David. We're all familiar with this story. And he had to tell him something terrible. You have sinned. That's not usually a message supreme kings want to hear. So he built a story. And what if you find yourself in a situation where you have to do something like that and you need to tell a story? What is a story? Well, a story is a character. You start with the character. Who is the character? It doesn't matter. In my case, it was a little boy. It was me. But you start with a character, and then you come over here and you establish what the character wants. So this is what the character wants. In my case, it was the cap gun, and it was me. But in between the character and what the character wants, you have to install an obstacle, a mountain, that the character has to get over in order to get what he wants. That works. It's a very simple story diagram, and it works. You can make it just a little more complicated. If you have nieces and nephews to tell stories to, you should be telling stories to them. That's how you practice being a parent. And it's just a good way to be a human. Put about three mountains in there. So now you have your character and you have your story. And he climbs this mountain and he looks over and he realizes there's a big valley. And there's an even bigger mountain on the other side. We did a little bit of that in our first story. The first mountain was, I wasn't going to get the gun. But then I did. My dad bought it for me. But then there's this big valley where I broke the gun in half, and getting the gun fixed again was out of my reach. But we went over the next mountain, and then we discovered, put about three mountains in there. That's ideal. And each one is higher than the next one. Each crisis is bigger than the crisis before. But then in Christian stories, there's something that's important, value stories. And that's that you want your character to start with something broken. And I'm not talking about a cap gun now. I'm talking about something inside the character that's broken. We can all relate to that because we all have things in our lives that are broken, don't we? Fears, unresolved problems, things that have not been worked through. And as your character progresses through your story, he's got to crawl over this first mountain. And you want him to do it through grit, just beating his way through it. Maybe get some help along the way. Then he gets over the second mountain, and it's going to take everything he has. And when he goes into that second valley after the second mountain, he's done. He doesn't have anything left. He's expended. At that point, he has to face those fears. He has to face that brokenness within himself. And in crawling over that third mountain, he has to leave something behind in the valley. He has to leave that brokenness and that fear behind. And he has to become something that he wasn't before. So when he ends a story, he is something he was not before. I like that quote about classics. They say when you reread an old classic, you don't see more in it than you saw before. There's more of you than there was before. You know, when you read a classic when you're 18 and then you read a classic when you're 50, there's this gap that can open up. But as you grow, you see more because there's more of you to see with. So that is a very brief primer on how to tell stories. And now I want to tell you another story. The story makes me look pretty bad. You know, why do people say, "Oh, tell me your most embarrassing moment"? It seems to be kind of a human universal. So this is one of my top five most embarrassing moments. I hope you're okay with hearing it. When I was about 13, I had an older sister who was 4.5 years older than me. And she lorded that over me in the appropriate ways of older sisters. She would want to go do something, and my mom would say, "Oh, I don't think Daryl's old enough to go." And I would say, "Beverly's doing it, and she's only 4 years older than me." And she would say, "I am 4.5 years older than you." And years later, when I was still a single young man, and she was married and had a whole string of children, and she was a deacon's wife, I said, "You know what, Beverly? I think you are 4.5 years older than me, actually." She was, anyway, so one night she was somehow got stuck taking care of me. Well, everybody else was somewhere else, and I don't know why. That's all lost to the dustbins of history. But she got a call on the phone, and she was 17, I think. So you back that down to my age, whatever I was, 12. And she got a call on the phone. "Hey, you need to come down to Brother Solly's house." "What for?" "Just come on down. Everything will be fine." Well, what was she going to do with me? She couldn't leave me at home by myself. That was not a safe idea because it was me, and she knew me. And that was not going to work. And so she said, "Well, I guess I'll have to take him along." So she went out, and she got in the car, and we had this Honda Accord, this old charcoal gray Honda Accord. It had been driven up and down cornfields so often, the bottom of it, they said, looked like it had been chromed. We all learned to drive stick shift on it, and even learned to drive stick shift without the clutch because it was shifted so smoothly you could be driving along it, and you get the RPM right, and it just drops right into gear. And we went out and got in this car, and I went in the garage, and I got, got to be prepared. You don't ever know what you're up against. Got a pair of handcuffs and a flashlight and put them in my pocket. Turns out I didn't need the handcuffs later. I mean, but I didn't know. And we drove down the road about 5 miles through the dark and turned in the lane and drove back this long lane with trees hanging kind of creepily over the lane to this house set way back off the road. I was sitting in the car and she was driving. We're going to the minister's house for whatever reason. There's something else you need to know about me at that point in my life. I was a miser. Just say it. There it is. I like to keep whatever money I got my hands on. I had this little puppy dog. Just saw one like in a convenience store just recently. Oh, I didn't know they were still around. fuzzy, the fuzz would wear off, and you could put your coins in the back. And when we would husk corn or whatever we would do, I would put my money in there. And then, oh, I was so miserly. It was this struggle, because when you'd husk corn, you get a penny a year, and then they'd take you out of the store, and you could use the money to buy a snack. But then you have to decide, do you actually want to eat the snack, and then it's gone, or do you want to put it in the puppy and keep it? Just a little insight into my childhood there. We're driving down this lane, and creepy trees are hanging over it, and we pull up to the house, and we walk in. And she gets out, and I get out, and she says, well, it looks like there's a party going on in there. I'll just go in and see what's going on. And she made a critical mistake. She walked in and left me outside by myself. I still think that was a pretty serious error of judgment on her part. But that's a lot of years ago, and we won't hold that against her. She left me outside in the dark. And this house was constructed, the back of it was constructed like this. So you had this big, tall, kind of cracker box house. And you had these two doors that went in the back. This, and then there's windows. And this door goes right into the kitchen. And when you go into the kitchen, that's where the party's happening. This door over here just goes into the laundry room. And there's a hall that comes down here. You can't see it from the outside, of course. But she left me standing out there. And there's windows. And there's windows on this side over here. And there's light shining out the windows. And I'm standing out there in the dark looking at this house, and it's kind of creepy out there. I mean, this house had a history of things happening, right? At least one thing. There was it's different than the children hadn't gotten married till older in life. And so you had some older ladies that hadn't gotten married. They called them old maids then. And they had a couple older men that hadn't gotten married, and the minister and his wife. And one night, one of these ladies woke up, and single ladies woke up in her bed, and she realized there was a man in her closet. She knew it. Imagination maybe ran in that community or something. Anyway, she knew it. So she got out of bed, and what do? You scream, or no, you got to go see what's in the closet, right? I don't know where the hell that logic ran, but she's crept across the room. She stood outside the closet door. She knew there was a man in there. She knew it. And she opened the door. And she reached into the closet. And somebody grabbed her. And she screamed, ah! And one of her brothers jumped out of bed, came running down the hall, and threw the door open and turned on the light. And there she was standing in the closet, holding onto her own arm like this. They were able to resolve that. The man, he was gone. And so things happen, and it was kind of a creepy place in some ways. First place I ever killed a poisonous snake, too, but that's another story. And I'm standing out there in the dark, and I thought, this is not right. I should do something. And so I walked out that long lane, turned left, walked down the road about 150 yards, turned right into a much shorter lane, and walked up to that house. It was my uncle Marcus's house. It was the preacher's son. He was married and had a whole family. And one of them was Brian, and he was my age. And he was a good sidekick. Sort of. I mean, we'll discuss that later. He was the type that would go with you, at least through some of it. And I knocked on the door, and somebody came and opened the door. And, Daryl, what are you doing here? Well, it's a long story, but I need Brian. Okay, so they sent Brian out. Brian said, Daryl, what are you doing here? Well, they're having a party or something over at your grandpa's place, and my sister went in because I was staying with her, and now they're all in there having a party, and I'm out here in the dark. I don't think it's right. Like, well, what do you want to do about it? Well, he said, we should do something. Can't let this injustice stand. We've got a crusade in the world and fix the injustices, right? I think we should do something. What do you think we should do? I don't have any ideas. Brian said, You know, he said, I have heard of this. My uncles talk about this thing called flipping the breaker. Okay, well, I'm listening. Let's talk about it. he said, well, there's these switches in the box. Yeah, I've seen the box. You know, the gray box on the wall with a little ring you open, and it's got all these black switches. Yeah. He said, well, if you flip the right switch in there, all the lights go out. And so the thing they were talking about is how you sneak into somebody's house when they're having a party, and you turn the switch off, and all the lights go out. Oh, that sounds great. You want to go over with me and do it? Well, I'll go over with you. So we walked out that lane. It wasn't down the road. We walked down the long lane with the trees hanging over. It wasn't as scary with him along because you can always... I could probably about outrun him, so I could feed him to whatever was going to come. And we got back the lane, and we stood behind this house here, and we looked at... The party's all going on in here. And I said, well, where's the breaker box? And Brian said, well, it's right inside that door there. Go in there. That's the laundry room. And it's all, this whole half of the house is darked out. He said, if you go in there, there's a breaker box. Okay. So I opened the door and crept in there. And sure enough, on the wall was this breaker box. Now, I had to cross the shaft of light that was coming down from the kitchen. The hall came down, and so the light was kind of running into this room here. But nobody was paying any attention because they were having a party down there and eating root beer floats. So I crept across the light, and I went over to the panel box on the wall. And I opened the panel box and looked, and there's all these black switches. Now, Brian, for some reason, was showing early signs of wisdom. They say young men do the things they do because the front part of their brains don't develop until later in life than girls. And maybe his was a little more developed than mine or something. But he's standing outside the door looking in. And he's saying, yeah, you got the right one, the right box. Well, if you've ever read like Tom Sawyer, how you overcomplicate everything, I felt like I needed another escape route. Well, right there, so the door is over here, breaker box, hallway, and there's a little, one of those little tiny bathrooms that you can't even put a sink in. You just walk in and you turn left, and there's a commode, and there, right above the commode, is this little window. Just a tiny little window. And I thought, that'd be a good second escape route. So I went over and I pushed that window up. And I went back out and I stood by the breaker box and I looked at it. What do I do? Brian's like, turn the breaker off. Just flip one of those switches. So I reached up and I got a hold of the switch and I flipped it. Chunk. You know what happened? Nothing. I mean, somewhere upstairs the alarm clocks are probably blinking, but nothing happened. I turned it back on again. Brian said, turn another one off. Okay. So I got another one, flipped it, shunk, nothing. So I turned it back on, and I'm looking at Brian. He's just peeking around in the door. Well, what do I do? I mean, this was your idea. I need some instruction here. He says, well, there's that big one up at the top. And I looked up, and sure enough, there's, you know, the double row of breakers. And up at the top, there's this big double-hinged one that's turned the other way. Try that one. Okay. I was just a little shrimp of a boy. I reached up there and got a hold of it, and I pulled, and it loaded up those two big cams, and they're loaded up. And all of a sudden, it cammed over center and went, shook, and the lights went out. And all of the people down the hall were talking like some young people did. And then I was down the other day and I was coming back and I was and drinking root beer floats. And just all of a sudden when that lights went out, it was complete silence. Which wasn't really what I was looking for at that point in my life. And the old minister, he liked his sayings. And some of them were random. This one was kind of. And he says, Haldeman Mennonite, what's going on? And I thought, I need to get out of here. That seemed like the thing to do. And then I made a mistake. If you ever find yourself in a situation where you need to flip off a breaker on somebody's party, you need to. Here's a bit of advice. Don't turn it back on. Somebody else will do that later. I turned it back on. And this shaft of light came shooting down that hallway at 186,000 miles a second and cut me off from my escape. So I jumped into the bathroom. There was nowhere to go from there, basically. I have to cross back through the beam of light, and now everybody knows there's a problem. And everything in my amygdala, you know, the part of your brain that doesn't think, it just says, go, 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 was yelling, go, go, go. So I'm standing in this tiny little bathroom, and there's an open window in front of me. And my brain is just shouting, go, go, go. So I went. I just went through the window head first. It was kind of beautiful. I mean, I was a streamlined little person, and I just shot through the window head first. Your hands out in front, kind of tucked position, through the window, and I just sailed through the window. Brian had come around the outside, and he was looking up at me, because it was 7 foot, you know, to the ground. And he's looking up at me, just imagine the scene, you know, there's a moon maybe hanging in the sky, just a touch of one, a few stars, this house newly lit back up, little boy shooting through the window head first. Everything was going great until I got to my knees. I didn't know it. I didn't have any interest in storm windows at that point. But there's this little aluminum lip that runs along the bottom of a storm window, and it's about this tall. And my knees caught right on, knobby little kneecaps, caught right on that little piece of aluminum. And it pulled. You would think the window would have somehow responded in a dignified manner. It didn't. Apparently, when they nailed it up there, they nailed all the one side to the studs. And they nailed all the other side into the soffit. So what happened is, the one side was basically holding nothing. And so when I nailed it with my kneecaps, it was already 3/4 of the way through, so it wasn't like I was going back. The one side, just all the nails came out simultaneously, and the window just opened right out, just like a door swung right out, and I'm hanging on it from my knees. And then that first nail, it actually opened like this. That first nail on the top left side, which is holding everything, went pop. And then the next nail, pop, 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 pop. And I just sailed right on out into the darkness with the window around my knee. And I did a beautiful 4-point landing in the yard. And that window broke itself over my behind. And I just jumped up and Brian said, go. And I'm like, that sounded like a wonderful idea. So my amygdala was screaming, go, go, go. And in the middle of that, so we ran. I mean, it's not like we were scared of anything. We hadn't done anything wrong. We were just exercising. And we ran across the yard till we got to the first big bush with a shadow around it. And then we dove under the bush because we were tired of exercising. And we were lying there under the bush. And the doors all come open, and people come streaming out, and they stand around looking at this window. It wasn't that interesting, folks. It was just a window. But they're all standing around looking at the window. So we're lying under the bush. And if you ever find yourself, like, fleeing a restricted country or something, and you're lying under a bush, and you're Caucasian like me, which means you don't have enough skin color, right? And somebody's looking for you, and they have the light. Don't look at the light. We looked because it was interesting. They're all looking at the window. It was interesting, right? And we're like hiding under the bush looking. And they look out across the yard. And I suppose what they saw was these two little white faces. And they're whiter than normal. And one of the old maids that lived in the house said, boys, we see you. I said to Brian, I don't think she sees us. You know, denial is a real thing. When you need to believe something, you'll believe it. And so we laid under the bush. After a while, when I'm yelled again, boys, we really do see you. Brian says, I think they see us. So we get up and we trudge back to the house. And we stand around in the circle and look at the broken. When I've stood around campfires, campfires are great to stand around and look into. Broken windows just don't have the pizzazz. Just say it. So they got a cardboard box, and one of the ladies got me to pick up all the broken glass and put it in the box because she said, you know, metal rusts down and wood will rot down, but glass lasts forever. So you got to pick it up. So I picked it up and put it in the box. You know what else lasts forever? humiliation. No, actually, it doesn't. Eventually, it will rot down into a story. And so I put the glass in the box. And about 3 weeks later or so, dear Brother Sally, he was one of my favorite ministers to listen to in the house, came up to me after church, and he put his hand on my shoulder, and he whispered in my ear, because he didn't want to embarrass me. That was my job, to embarrass me. Put his hand on my shoulder and said, got the window fixed. So it's all taken care of. It was $32.50. Remember, I was a miser. And money came to me very, very slowly because I didn't have any way of making money. But I did have the little puppy dog bank with all the money in it. And I'd actually saved up more than $32. So I went to that little bank and I opened it up and pulled out those $1 bills and quarters one at a time. So I had the big stack and I took it and got on my bike and rode 5 miles down the road and gave that money to dear Brother Saleh, who so justly deserved it. And we can look at that and say, that's a crazy story. Wow. But we can learn something from stories. When we do things in life, they will have consequences. When we do good things, we have good consequences. When we do bad things, we have bad consequences. And now that I'm older, I find that I'm often on the conservative end of whatever's happening. And it may be working some of it out of my system when I was 12. I don't know. But I see people making decisions, all sorts of decisions. Decisions about who to marry, and decisions about what church to go to, and decisions about what influences they want to allow into their lives. And I find myself looking at them and thinking, wait, are you sure you want to do that? Like, you're just very casually leaving the church you're part of and going to a church that allows you more of what you want for no other reason than because it allows you more of what you want. But you're also getting a lot of other things in the package that you may not have accounted for. And there's going to be a whole consequence set with that. And some of those consequences are going to have a long, long period of reaping. And it could be 5 years. It could be 50 years. It could be 100 years. Your grandchildren could still be dealing with this. And we hope that we get to the bad consequence and we find out that we only have to raid our piggy bank for the money that's in it. And that it really only was $32.50. But I think that we're going to get to the end of life and we're going to find that there's people who have unknowingly spent a lot more than they could afford to spend. I was at a wedding a while back, and the preacher said something kind of shocking. But my wife and I discussed it, and we feel like he was basically on track. He said, ladies, when you marry a man, you are essentially trusting your eternal destiny into his hands. There is an element in which that's not true. God is still God and still gracious, and he can make a way for you. But if you get my age and older, there's an awful lot of truth to it, too. There's an awful lot of truth to it. And men, when you decide to move to another church, you're accepting a lot more than simply whatever it was you thought you were going to get when you went there. And that's going to affect your eternal destiny and your wife and your children and your grandchildren. This story is about consequences. And there always is consequences. Make sure you think through what you do. You want to marry a boy? That's wonderful. Start a family. Think it through very carefully. What's his character like? You want to go to another church because you feel like it's a better fit for your spirituality? Think it through very, very carefully. Don't just ask if I'm getting what I want. Ask, am I getting what I need? Because we're really good at telling ourselves stories about stories that aren't true. Stories that are only true because we want them to be true. And then we get to the end and we realize they weren't true at all. So that is what I have for you. Those two stories from my childhood. One of them is about passing on values. One of them is about consequences. Make sure that you live your life in such a way that the consequences you suffer are good ones. That the consequences you experience are good ones. And make sure you live your life in such a way that the values that you hold are passed on through story to the people who need them. Thank you.